This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Night Transmissions. By now, most of you know what we do around here. You know about the old radio shows, and we're just going to do it again. First up this week is the most successful radio play ever made. This is a show that routinely shows up on every list of the best radio shows compiled by everyone who bothers to make such a list. From May the 23rd of 1948, we have Lenington versus the Ants, based on a story by Carl Stevenson. This story was first published in the December 1938 edition of Esquire. According to Wikipedia, this was the only story that Stevenson allowed it to be published in his life. I don't know. I do know that there was a historian of medieval history of the same name, and I think it was the same man, but I'm not sure. Well, maybe you know. If you do, say so. Anyway, the action is set in the Brazilian wilderness, where Leningen owns a large plantation and faces a column 10 miles long, 2 miles wide of ants, each ant the size of a man's thumb, and they will eat anything that gets in their way, including Leningen's plantation and Leningen himself. Here we go.
You are isolated on a remote plantation in the crawling Amazon jungle, and an immense army of ravenous ants is closing in on you, swarming in to eat you alive. A deadly black army from which there is no escape.
Escape, produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and carefully contrived to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight we escape to the Amazon jungle and to a creeping, crawling terror, as Carl Stevenson told it in his gripping story, Leningen versus the Ants.
I first met Leningen while performing my duty as district commissioner. As my boat neared his plantation landing, I saw him upon the riverbank, regarding me with mild interest. A great hulk of a man with bristling gray hair, bulky nose, and pale eyes. His entire appearance somehow suggested an aging and shabby eagle. He escorted me to the terrace and had a drink brought. I came quickly to the point of my visit and issued my warning. Leningen puffed placidly at a huge cigar and listened as I told him, unless they alter their course, and there's no reason why they should, they'll reach your plantation in 2 days at the latest.
Uh-huh. Well, it was decent of you paddling all this way just to give me the tip.
Tip?
Commissioner, even a herd of crocodiles couldn't drive me from this plantation of mine.
But these aren't creatures you can fight. They're an elemental force, a gigantic catastrophe. 10 miles long, 2 miles wide, ants, nothing but ants, and each one as big as your thumb, and each of them a fiend from hell. Unless you clear out at once, there'll be nothing left of you but a skeleton picked as clean as your own plantation will be.
I'm not getting out.
But you can't fight.
Yes, I can. I've got the best weapon there is, Commissioner. Intelligence.
But can't I make you understand the hit?
I think it is you who do not understand. In the 3 years I've been here, I've met and defeated more than one catastrophe. Flood, drought, a plague. Events which caused many of my neighbors to flee for their lives. No, Commissioner, all my life I have lived with one creed. The human brain needs only to become fully aware of its powers to conquer even the elements.
Lannington, your obstinacy is endangering not only your own life, but the lives of your workers and their families. You don't know these ants. I tell you, you don't know these ants. But Lannington merely sat there puffing at his cigar and regarding me with a smug grin, and I knew it was hopeless. As I boarded my launch and cast off, I realized I'd never met a man like that. And I could not help wondering
about the strange look in the commissioner's eyes as he boarded his launch and cast off. Undoubtedly, he thought me insane. Well, he would not have been the first to think so. But I, Leiningen, knew my own powers. I was sure of myself. I knew that intelligence, directed aright, always makes man the master of his fate. That night, I called my Indian workers together in front of the plantation house. I saw their faces go ashen with terror as I told them that the ants were coming. Watched them as they milled around, muttering. I said nothing more to them. Finally, one of the men stepped forward. Blas, the foreman.
Patron, we have worked hard here for these 3 years. All of us. We have built the finest plantation in this district. We all share in it. It has been a home for all of us and our families. Now the ants come.
So?
Those ditches we dug last year, the pipe we put in the ground, that was for the ants?
Yes, that was for the ants.
If we moved our families across the river, the ants could not reach them?
Yes, that's right. And you?
The ants are mighty. We know what they can do. All of us think that you are mighty. Patron, we will stay with you and fight against the ants.
I knew that the men would give me that answer. I counted on it. I thought of the commissioner and wondered what he would say in such unquestioning confidence. Would he still think I was insane? Or had he dismissed
it out of my mind? One man who calmly evaluated his chances against a deadly menace, coolly decided he could win and was willing to stake his life on it, to risk a horrible death for it. It was terrifying. And yet it was fascinating. The next morning I sent for my assistant. Together we went to the huge map of the district which hung from a wall of my office and checked the last reported position of the ants.
Last night they had reached here. About 70 miles above this fork in the river.
Traveling southeast?
Yes.
Directly toward Lannington.
Toward whom, sir?
That plantation at the bend in the river belongs to a man named Lannington. When would you say the ants will reach there?
I don't know. I imagine about tomorrow noon.
Tomorrow noon. Still time.
Still time? What do you mean, sir?
Why nothing. But what did I mean? Still time for what? For Lannington to flee, or still time for me to... Even as I rejected the thought with horror, I knew that the fascination of that man was more than I could resist. That Lannington's fight was drawing me back toward that plantation and death. I knew now past all doubt that I was going back. I had to. It was 10 o'clock in the morning when I rounded the bend and saw Lannington's plantation before me. I put in at the dock and tied up the launch. Then I saw him standing on the bank above me, arms folded, stubby cigar in his mouth, and that same smug grin on his face. I made my way up to him.
Back with another warning, Commissioner?
No.
Back to stay a while?
Yes. You don't seem surprised.
No, I'm not.
You expected me?
I thought you'd be back. Yeah, come along. We'll get some horses. You'll want to ride around the plantation, take a look at the defenses I've rigged up.
Yes, I want to see the defenses.
And the ants. We'll be getting a glimpse of them before long, I should think.
Yes, the ants. defenses Leiningen had devised were quite impressive. Surrounding three sides of the plantation like a huge horseshoe was a ditch 12 feet wide. The ends of this horseshoe-shaped ditch ran into the river, which formed the foreside of the plantation. And at the upriver entrance to the ditch, Leiningen had constructed a dam by which the river water could be diverted into the ditch. A large handwheel controlled the floodgate of the dam, and apparently Leiningen had ordered it opened immediately after my arrival. Whereas we now approached the ditch and rode along it, I could see that it was nearly full.
How do you like my first line of defense, Commissioner?
It's reassuring, like a moat around a castle.
Unless the ants know how to build rafts, they won't reach the plantation. But this is only the outer moat. There's a better one than this. Now, come along. We'll go up to the high ground where the buildings are. I can get a view from there.
Leiningen.
Huh?
I didn't see any women or children around the plantation or any animals.
Yes, that's right. Moved them across the river.
And even you think there is danger.
Not because of danger, Commissioner. Matter of efficiency.
Efficiency?
Yes, cuts down on the efficiency of the men if they're worried about their families. Critical situations only become crises when oxen and women get excited.
I see.
Ah, here we are. Yeah, see the ditch?
It's much smaller than the others.
Yes, you've noticed how all the buildings are on this piece of high ground. The inner ditch surrounds them, and it's lined with concrete.
But even filled with water, this is no barrier. It's not big enough. Why, if the ants get this far,
they'll get no farther. This ditch wasn't built for water, Commissioner. You see the pipes leading into it? See those storage tanks on the hill? Petrol. We can throw up a wall of flame. Care to bet they won't like that?
I hope you're right. Leiningen, look. Over at the edge of the jungle, all those animals.
Yes. Running like the wind. Everything from jaguars to monkeys.
Good heavens.
Remember, they don't have any ditches.
But can they escape?
Now, they'll be all right as long as they don't get caught between the river and the ants. They can outrun the crawlers. But if they get trapped, it's either the ants or the crocodiles. Ah, look, look. Up there over the horizon. There are your ants. Look at them.
Was a sight I will never forget. Over the range of hills, as far as I could see, crept a darkening hem, ever longer and broader until the shadow sped across the entire slope, then downward. Downward, uncannily swift, and all the green herbage on the entire slope was being mowed as by a giant sickle, leaving only the vast moving shadow extending and deepening, and always moving nearer.
They're a hideous lot.
Leiningen, we can't last against that. Look at them. Why, they will fill your ditches with their corpses and still have enough to destroy every one of us. We've got to run.
Well, No, they haven't gotten to us yet, and they never will.
The hostile army was approaching in perfect formation. No human battalions, however well-drilled, could ever hope to rival the precision of that advance. Along a front that moved forward as uniformly as a straight line, the ants drew nearer and nearer to the water ditch. As they approached, two outlying wings of the army detached themselves from the main body and started marching along the sides of the ditch, no doubt expecting at some point to find a crossing. And during this hour-long flanking movement, the main army remained still. Across the scant 12 feet of ditch, I stared at them, and they stared back at me. A solid mass, everyone as big as my thumb, with reddish-black body and long legs. Suddenly, a sound so unearthly as to freeze our blood jerked our heads in the direction of the jungle on the far side of the ditch. Coming toward the ditch at a stumbling gallop was a singular being, a writhing, animal-like, blackened statue with a shapeless head and four quivering feet. It was a stag, covered over and over with ants. Leiningen threw up his rifle, and the stag fell lifeless to the ground, its agonies at an end. Horrified as I was, my curiosity impelled me to glance at my watch. I had to know how long the ants would take. Long minutes, only the white polished bones of the stag remained. Now I could see a change in Leiningen. Gone was the sporting zest of the novel contest. In its place was a cold, violent purpose. He had to beat the ants because he now knew how long it would take them once they got to us. Around 4 in the afternoon, the ant scouts, having found no crossing, there was a stirring among the main army. And then an immense flood of ants, about 100 yards in width, commenced pouring in a glimmering black cataract down the flower slope of the ditch. Thousands drowned instantly, but the rest began using the bodies as bridges. Leiningen immediately swung into action.
Press the dam, open the floodgate a little more. We've got to get the water in the ditch moving faster.
Sí, señor.
Look at them drowned in a pulse.
But they keep coming. Even though the current carries many of them away, they're advancing.
Well, we'll fix them. What?
Yes, señor.
How about those shovels and petrol sprinklers? You pass them out to the men?
Yes, sir, it has been done.
Then get all hands here in a hurry. This looks like a spot for action. Hey. Commissioner.
Yes?
Beginning to see what I was talking about?
What do you mean?
About intelligence being more than a match for anything it tackles. Take the ants. They've got no intelligence. If they had, they'd have attacked along the whole length of the ditch instead of a narrow front like this. They'd have been across by now. No. Too bad I'm not running their campaign for them.
You can joke about it like that with ants halfway across the...
All right, men! Busy with the shovels now! Jump some sand and clods on them. See how they like that! You with the petrol sprinklers! Stop popping! Aha! They don't like it, Commissioner. They don't like it a bit. Look at them!
Yes. But look at the ones on the far side of the ditch. Whole clumps of them rolling into the water. The rest are using them for bridges.
Yes. Smarter than I thought. They're widening their front, too.
Some of them are getting across.
Grab a shovel, then, Commissioner. Make them regret it.
Wait!
What's the matter?
I think you're a shovel, Senor. Let out my eyes.
Petrol, idiot. Drop your hands in the petrol. Don't stop now, the rest of you. Cover them. Cover them.
We cannot hold it back, Senor. We must run.
Keep at it. Keep at it. Don't stop now. Aha! Uh-huh. Oh, the water's moving faster.
And y'all got the floodgates open.
Yes. They can't hold their own against the current now. Look at them, Commissioner. The water's carrying them away. We've beat them. We've won out.
It was true. Leiningen had won. At least the opening round. The floodgates were left open to forestall any night crossing. But when dawn came, the dark blanket was still there, motionless, across the ditch. Then we noticed a feverish activity on the other side of the plantation. Here a grove of tamarind trees lined the far end of the ditch, and every tree swarmed with the crawling insects. But instead of eating the leaves, they were merely gnawing through the stems so that a thick green shower fell steadily to the ground. Well, it looks as if it's feeding time for our friends, eh?
Blas.
Senor.
Have all the petrol pumps brought here. Get everyone over here except the lookouts on the other side. Then pass out the shovels.
Si, senor.
Going to deprive them of a meal?
A meal?
Aren't they cutting down the leaves for food?
No. I wish they were. Looks like I underestimated them when I said they didn't have intelligence.
What do you mean?
I said if they wanted to get across, they'd have to have rafts. And that's just what they've got. Those leaves are their rats.
Even as he spoke, the leaves went tumbling down the far bank by the thousands. The current drew them away from the bank, and each leaf carried several ants.
Don't worry, as long as you can keep spraying them and shoveling dirt on their rafts, they can't land.
But there will be too many.
It's true. Look, more leaves in the ditch all the time. Why, they'll have a solid carpet to walk across in a minute.
Not so fast, Commissioner. I've still got a trick up my sleeve for them.
They're walking.
The ditch is drying up.
Yes, of course it's drying up. That's the plan. Those are the orders I sent to the dam.
Are you mad? As soon as it's empty, what's to prevent the... Look, the water's way down. It's almost dry. They'll be able to come across the bottom.
They'll not make it. The man at the dam will have opened the gates by now.
To flood the ants?
Right.
But what a chance to take. If anything should happen...
Here it comes. Here comes the water. Yes, we'll give the crawlers a ditch to ride in. Right out to the river. Look at them go.
Leiningen's tactics were successful at first. The violent flow of water at the original depth raced through the ditch, overwhelming leaves and ants and sweeping them along. 3 times the ditch was emptied. Three times the ants raced across its bottom, and three times the rushing water, arriving just in time, carried them away. But the fourth time, as the water lowered nearly to the bottom of the ditch, we waited in vain for the rushing water, and then...
What's the matter? What's gone wrong at the dam?
The ants. Just as the man at the dam lowered the water almost to the bottom, the ants attacked. Before he could open the floodgate, he was almost surrounded. He ran. The ants kept coming. They are across the ditch.
Leiningen stood motionless, absorbing the news of his defeat without a word. Then he raised his pistol and fired three shots into the air. The prearranged signal for all the men to retreat instantly to the second line of defense, the concrete ditches more than a mile from the point of the invasion. Soon after we arrived there, the natives commenced straggling in silently. Leiningen waited until all of them had gathered, then he spoke to them.
Well, lads, we won the first round and lost the second, but we'll smash the crawlers yet. Anyone who thinks otherwise can draw his pay and push off. There are rafts enough on the river and plenty of time still to reach them. You'll stay then. Good. Thank you, lads. And you, Commissioner?
I can't persuade you to give up the fight?
You cannot.
Then I stay, too.
Yeah. I knew you would.
Senor! You are the ants to read the ditch.
They're trying to get across?
No, senor.
I didn't think they would. There's plenty of food out there for them. My fields and orchards, the work of 3 years. Ought to last them until morning, anyway.
Yes, we were safe for that night. But the next morning, the black swarm was solid around us, and their shock troops were hard at work. They were dropping shreds of bark and twigs and leaves into the petrol-filled ditches, forming a floating bridge across the surface of the liquid. Leiningen stood silently watching this operation, and I could see a grudging admiration in his face. Then, after several hours, the attack came. Down the ditch they poured, millions of them, and across the bridge of twigs, rapidly approaching the inner side. Leiningen sat motionless, watching them. Leiningen, for the love of God, don't sit there like a statue. They'll be on us in a moment.
Let them fill the ditch first. Now. All right. Everyone back. Block. Hand me the torch. Now we'll see how our friends like a little heat.
Flames from the ditch shot into the air, devouring ants by the millions. It was some time before the petrol burned down to the bed of the ditch, but when it did, the devils came back for more. Again, Leiningen fired the ditch to destroy them. And still again they came on, but at each successive firing, the task of the ants grew easier because of the film of ash which now covered the petrol. And as they returned to the assault time after time, a slow, sickening horror crept into my mind. I looked quickly at Leiningen, then at the petrol tanks. He read my gaze and nodded slowly.
That's right, Commissioner. We could hold them off forever if our supply of petrol was unlimited. But it isn't. We've got enough to fill the ditch once more.
Leiningen, isn't there any way at all? We've got to do something.
I know. There must be a way. There must be. Yes.
What is it?
We'll flood the whole plantation.
Flood? But how?
The river's higher than any point except this high ground we're on now. If the river was dammed all the way, it'd overflow that stone breakwater and flood the whole plantation. We've got to close the floodgate at the dam. That'll do it.
You're mad. The dam is more than a mile away. More than a mile away.
Lads, listen to me. Listen, lads, I'm proud of you. Now, there's still a chance. By shutting the floodgates from the dam and flooding the whole plantation from the river, the moment I'm over the ditch, set fire to it. That'll allow time for the flood to wash away the ants. But all you'll have to do is wait for me.
It's impossible. You can't get to the dam, let alone back.
That's why you're wrong, Commissioner. I'll get there, and I'll get back. Take care of things while I'm gone, huh?
I watched him as he calmly pulled on high leather boots, drew gauntlets over his hand and stuffed the spaces between breeches and boots, gauntlets and arms, with petrol-soaked rags. He shielded his eyes with close-fitting mosquito goggles and plugged his nostrils and ears with cotton. Then the natives drenched his clothes with petrol. Blas, who acted as doctor to the men, smeared a salve over him, and finally Leiningen was ready. As he stood calmly surveying...
Ready for the run, I realized that this is as it should be. I, Leiningen, would meet the ants and defeat them, or be defeated by them. Leiningen versus the ants. Yes, it was right that it should be like this. But now there was no more time for thought, only action. I took a deep breath and then bounded across the ditch and among the ants. I ran at long equal strides with one thought, one sensation in my being. I must get through. I dodged the trees and shrubs. Except for the split seconds my soles touched the ground, the ants would have no opportunity to alight on me. I ran on. I was halfway to the dam before I felt ants under my clothes and a few on my face. I struck under them mechanically, scarcely conscious of their bites. And the dam drew toward me slowly. And the distance grew less. Less. Finally, only 100 yards away. 50. Then I was there. I gripped the ant-covered wheel, but... oddly, had I seized it when a hood of ants flowed over my hands and arms. I strained, and slowly the wheel turned. And turned more. And the floodgate was swinging slowly shut. Then it was shut. And the water was rising. Rising behind the breakwater. Closer to the top. Closer. And then it was spilling over. Flooding of the plantation of the gun. I let go of the wheel and started back through the ants. I was coated from head to foot with the fiends. Tongues of fire stabbed at me as they bit into my flesh. I almost lost my head with the pain as I ran, knocking ants from my body, brushing them from my bloody face. And then one bit me just below the rim of my goggles. I managed to tear him away. But the agony of the bite and its venom drilled into the eye nerves. I saw now through circles of fire into a milky mist. I was almost blinded. But I knew that if I tripped and fell... I ran on, my heart pounding as if it would burst. Blood roaring in my ears, a giant's fist battering my lungs. And then I could see dimly that wall of flame at the ditch, but it was so far away. I could not last half that distance. I stumbled and fell. Felt myself being swarmed over, devoured. Tried to rise. A great weight. And then suddenly, the vision of the half-devoured stag in my brain. 6 minutes, then nothing but bones. I couldn't let that happen to me. I couldn't die like that. To my feet. To my feet. Drag myself forward. Saw the flame. The ditch. The ring of flame. Closer now. Only a little closer.
It seemed we had waited for hours when all at once through the blazing ring around us an apparition hurtled and fell full length on the ground. It was Leiningen, alive with ants, unconscious, with glazing eyes and lacerated face. We rushed to him, stripped off his clothes, and tore at the ants that covered him. His body seemed almost one open wound. In one place, I could see a white bone. Later, as the curtain of flame lowered, I looked out where the blanket of ants had been and saw only a vast expanse of water, covering the entire plantation and working its way to within a few feet of the concrete ditch. The ants were gone, drowned, and Leiningen had won. He lay on his bed, his body swathed from head to foot with bandages, but alive and still in command.
Everything in order?
Everything's in order.
I told you I'd come back. Even if I am a bit streamlined.
Escape, is produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and tonight brought you Leiningen versus the Ants by Carl Stevenson, adapted for radio by Robert Reif, with William Conrad as Leiningen and Lou Merrill as the commissioner. Music was conceived and conducted by Cy Cure.
Well, if that seemed familiar to you, and you know that you've never heard the play, that could very well be because you have seen the movie The Naked Jungle from 1954, which was the film treatment of Carl Stevenson's story, which starred Charlton Heston and Eleanor Parker. Moving on to segment two, we have a play from The Black Mass. This is an adaptation of another classic story, this time the Henry James short story, The Jolly Corner. In The Jolly Corner, Spencer Bryden will meet his fate. This show aired on January the 7th of 1965. Now, most people think of Henry James as a British writer, and with good reason. But he was born in the United States, moving to England when he was quite young, and would, near the end of his life, become a British subject. But wherever he lived, he was the writer of a raft of some of the best ghost stories ever written. Here we go.
Welcome to the Black Mass. We present an adaptation for radio of The Jolly Corner by Henry James.
I know it's only a detail, Denver, but let's stick to the plan. No harm so far, but it's good we caught it in time. All right. We'll meet in the morning for another look. All right, then.
Careful there, Alice. I'm sorry I had to stop, but you know you have to keep watch.
I'm impressed.
Impressed?
The way you stood up. Think of it. All these years, you may have neglected your real gift.
Building skyscrapers?
Yes. If you had stayed in America, you may have discovered your real genius.
Adding more awful architecture to all this bigness.
Do you find it all really more awful now?
Ah, they were ugly enough then, I remember. But with some charm. Now, proportions and values are upside down. The modern is monstrous.
But you're here, and that's what you think of everything.
Everything. That's too much. I dodge the question. Everything has somehow been a surprise, but even so, my thoughts are almost altogether about something that concerns only myself.
Your property?
Yes. Yes, exactly. I had to come back eventually to look after my property. This new monster is only a renovation. The apartment has flourished all along. I've managed to live for more than 30 years in Europe on the leases. My back turned. Now I've had no trouble catching on, climbing ladders, learning about materials, looking wise. It's actually been charming. Amusing, catching on to it this way.
Well, you're going to be well off for it, too. Astonishingly much, I should say. You can turn your back again.
Well, I don't know yet.
You mean you'll live here, in one of your marble towers?
Oh, never. I have my other property, you know.
Oh, yes, the old place, you mean, on the corner. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you kept it.
You kept it? Oh, yes, I've kept it. It's for that, I think, really, that I returned. I yielded to a humor I've had.
It hasn't changed. No. I've passed now and again. It's still as it was, except that it's empty. The corner has changed, I'm afraid.
Ah, yes, the corner. The Jolly Corner. I called it that, and it was. I was very fond of it as a child. The happy years growing up there. Ah, finally, after my brothers died, the property came wholly into my hands. Yes, I suppose it was to see my house on the Jolly Corner again, as much as anything that I came back.
Are we walking there now? I was hoping you'd show me.
Do you mind if we stop for a moment? Would you like to see it?
Oh, of course. Is it really empty all this while?
Entirely. Except for Mrs. Muldoon, good woman who lives in the neighborhood. She comes by every day to open windows and dust and sweep.
Oh, it must have been her I saw once when I passed.
No doubt. Do you pass often?
Oh, now and then. To get to the downtown...
You see? Empty. Empty. Vacancy reigns from top to bottom.
Oh, who's there? Is it you, Mr. Brighton?
Yes, it's me, Mrs. Muldoon. I brought a visitor.
Oh, you gave me a start, you did. Ma'am?
This is Miss Staverton.
Hello, Mrs. Muldoon.
Don't let us interrupt, Mrs. Muldoon. We're just going to look about.
There's no trouble, Mr. Brighton. I know you usually come later in the day. But let me push back some of the shutters and let in some light. Oh, to show you, sir, how little there is to see, I'm afraid. The rooms are enormous.
Too large, I'm afraid, for the times. For me.
Unless you were a billionaire.
Ah, yes. Had I but stayed at home and invented skyscrapers.
The dining room is off there. But if you will, you can look down here later. It's my noonday round before leaving, and I can open up for you upstairs.
Oh, don't bother about us, Mrs. Muldoon. We'll just walk about.
Oh, no bother at all, Mr. Brighton. I'm only too glad to oblige. There's only one request I hope you never make of me, sir.
Well, and what's that?
Well, if you should wish for any reason to come in after dark, I would just have to tell you, if you please. Mm-hmm. But you must ask it of someone else.
You mean there are things to see, then?
It's what you might see, miss. And I put it to you that no lady could be expected to like scraping up to them top stories in the evil hours, could she?
Evil hours? Oh,
what with the gas and electricity off there evil enough, I've sometimes been late enough to need a taper, and it's been a gruesome march through all them grey rooms.
I can imagine it, Mrs. Muldoon.
What do you imagine? Ghosts? Do you imagine my Jolly Corner is haunted? Well, there'd be nothing to fear.
Eh? Maybe. But I'm not of a mind to find that out, Mr. Brighton. Now, I'll go ahead and open things and leave you to your own. Then I must go off if you're not be needing anything.
Well, thanks, Mrs. Muldoon. I'll lock up when we leave.
Ma'am.
There used to be a fine view here of the river. There you can still see a slice of it between the buildings.
10 stories higher, you'd have your view again. I suppose that's what they want. To pull this place to pieces and start up.
Ah, it's exactly what they want. They're at me daily. They can't for their lives understand a man's liability to decent feelings. There are, after all, other values.
In short, you're to make so good a thing of your skyscraper that those ill-gotten gains will afford you to be sentimental here.
Well, yes, exactly. But is it sentimental? No, it's more. It searches me as I wander about.
Oh, you prowl?
Mere sight of the walls, shapes of the rooms, sound of the floors. This old silver-plated knob. I hold it and feel the slightest pressure of other palms. Dead ones now. 70 years of the past. The ashes of my youth still afloat in the air. Well, I thought I had forgotten.
But you can live here again if you decide to stay on.
I might have lived here. I might have put in here all these years. Then everything would have been different enough. Ah, but that's another matter. I can't now. And so the beauty of it, of my perversity, my refusal to tear it down, is the total absence of a reason. If there were reason, it would have to be a matter of dollars. So we'll have none. Not the ghost of one.
Are you very sure that the ghost of one doesn't, sir?
Oh, ghosts. Of course the place must swarm with them. I should be ashamed of it if it didn't. Poor Mrs. Muldoon's right, and it's why I haven't asked her to do more than look in.
Well, if it were only furnished and lived in.
Ah, for me it is lived in. For me it is furnished.
Ah, yes.
Well, this old elm lives on.
What a charming garden.
The memory is so alive. So alive. Mother. Father. My dear sister. That was her room up there with the balcony. I've seen her 1,000 times sitting there, looking down. Calling. Ah, my brothers. They're all gone. Simply having run their course. Having met their end one way or another.
And what would have become of you?
Ah, yes. All things come back to that. What might I have been? What course would I have run? An absurd, but I must admit, an intense speculation.
A morbid obsession?
What would it have made of me? What? I keep forever thinking about it. Idiotically, how could I possibly know?
Well, you see what it has made of others.
Something. Would it have made something of me?
Well, you're something else.
Oh, Alice, I'm nothing. Nothing. Nothing at all.
You followed your own preference. That's something.
Yes, Europe. Europe running off. I liked it. I loved it. If I'd only the least doubt, I would have stuck it out here. But I was too young, 27. That small, tight bud transplanted to a climate that blighted him once and for all.
You wonder about the flower. So do I. I've been wondering these several weeks. I believe in the flower. It would have been quite splendid, quite huge and monstrous.
Ah, monstrous. Monstrous above all. And I imagine by the same stroke quite hideous and offensive.
You don't believe that. If you did, you wouldn't wonder. You'd know, and that would be enough for you. What you feel, and what I feel for you, is that you'd have had power.
You'd have liked me that way.
How should I not have liked you?
I see. You'd have liked me, preferred me, a billionaire.
How should I not have liked you?
Well, I know at least what I am. I've not been edifying. I believe I'm thought in 100 quarters to have been barely decent. I followed strange paths and worshipped strange gods. It must have come to you again and again. In fact, you've admitted as much, that I was leading all these 30 years a selfish, frivolous, scandalous life. And you see what it has made of me.
You see what it has made of me.
Oh, you're a person whom nothing could have altered. You were born to be what you are, anywhere, anyway. You've the perfection nothing else could have blighted. If I hadn't left, don't you see how I'd never have waited till now?
The great thing to see seems to me to be that it hasn't spoiled anything. It hasn't spoiled your being here at last. It hasn't spoiled this. It hasn't spoiled your speaking or...
Do you believe then that I am as good as I might have been?
Oh, no, far from it. But I don't care.
You mean that I'm good enough?
Will you believe it if I say so? I mean, will you let that settle the question for you?
There's an idea. Some idea. Dear, which, however absurd, I cannot yet bargain away.
Oh, you see, you don't care either. but very differently. You don't care for anything but yourself.
Exactly, exactly. But he isn't myself. He's the just so totally other person. But I do want to see him. And I can. And I shall.
Yes. You shall. Well, in any case, I've seen him.
You?
I've seen him in a dream.
Oh, a dream.
But twice. I saw him as I see you now.
You've dreamed the same dream?
Twice over. The very same.
You dream about me at that rate?
Ah, about him.
Ah. Then you know all about him. Well, what's the wretch like?
I'll tell you sometime. Some other time.
It was after that visit with Alice that there was most of a virtue for me in surrender to my obsession. I sometimes came twice in the 24 hours. I projected myself all day straight over the bristling line of hard, unconscious heads and into the other, the real, the waiting life. The moments I liked best were those of gathering dusk, of the short autumn twilight. The time which again and again I found myself hoping most. Listening. Feeling my attention, never before so fine, on the pulse of the great, vague place. I always caught the effect of the steel point of my stick on the old marble of the hall pavement, on the black and white squares, where I played once, long ago. A dim reverberating tinkle from the depths of the house, of the past. Of that mystical other world that might have flourished for me had I not abandoned it. I'd put my stick noiselessly away in a corner, then feel the place in the lightness of some great glass bowl, all precious concave crystal set delicately humming by the play of a moist finger round its edge. The concave crystal held this mystical other world, and the murmur of its rim was the sigh there, the scarce audible pathetic wail of all the baffled, forsworn possibilities. What I did was to wake them. They were shy, all but unappeasably shy, but they weren't really sinister. At least, not before they had taken the form I so yearned to make them take. The form I hunted. Hunted. Hunted from room to room, story to story. Long after midnight, with my glimmering light, moving it slowly, holding it high. And he... Oh, he would roam restlessly too. When I stopped, I could hear him. He was cautious, shifty. His evasion laying on me finally a rigor to which nothing in my life has been comparable. No pleasure as fine as this tension. No sport demanding the patience and nerve of this stalking a creature more subtle, more formidable than any beast of the forest. I'd place my light on some mantel shelf and step back into a shelter or shade as if a rock or tree, holding my breath, living in the joy of the instant. With habit and repetition, I gained to an extraordinary degree the power to penetrate the distances, the darkness of corners, to resolve back into their innocence, the treacheries of uncertain light, the evil-looking forms taken in the gloom by mere shadows, by accidents of the air, by shifting effects of perspective. Putting down my light, I could still wander on without it, pass into other rooms, see my way, visually project a comparative clearness. It made me feel this acquired faculty like some monstrous stealthy cat. I wondered if I would have glared at these moments with large shining yellow eyes, and what it would be for my poor hard-pressed alter ego to be confronted with such a creature. Apparitions. Oh, apparitions. People have been in terror of apparitions, but who had ever before so turned the tables and become himself in the apparitional world an incalculable terror? I liked the open shutters. I opened everywhere those Mrs. Muldoon had closed, closing them as carefully afterward. I liked, and above all in the upper rooms, the sense of the hard silver of the autumn stars through the window panes, the flare of the street lamps below. That was human, actual, social. The world I had lived in. That light supported me mostly in the rooms to the front and the prolonged side, though it failed me in the central shades and the part at the back. There the house was the very jungle of my prey. The place was more subdivided there. Small rooms for servants had been multiplied. Nooks and corners abounded, and there was a back staircase over which I leaned many a time to look far down. My whole perception was open to cultivation, bringing it to perfection by practice, grown already so fine that I could hear. Well, there was something unmistakable. I felt it as I walked. I was being kept in sight, tracked at a distance, so that I should appear less arrogantly to myself merely to pursue. I'd make abrupt turns, wheel about, stop, seek it out. I had kept vistas clear, doors open, so that in the darkness my imagination might almost achieve it, project it, project into it. A refinement, a beauty. I had known 50 times the start of perception that had afterwards dropped, had 50 times gasped, there, 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 under some fond, brief hallucination. But he'd retreat, retreat. Though he retreated more reluctantly as time went on. Then, finally, one night, at the top among the more intricate rooms, he was there. He was there, waiting, not falling back, waiting at the far end of a series of rooms I had just passed through, waiting, worked up finally to anger, ready to fight. Thus we stood. Both terror and what? Rejoicing. terror, but also relief that in that other form I could inspire such fear. Thus we were one and the same. The door between the rooms was open, and from a second another opened to a third. But there the chain ended. The third door, which had only moments before been indubitably open, had subsequently been closed. I stood before it. The question of danger loomed, and with it, as never before, the question of courage. For what I knew the blank face of the door to say was, "Show us how much you have. Show us how much you have." It stared, glared back at me with that challenge, and he behind it shut up, defiant, turning the situation. Oh, discretion. Discretion. It could take its time. But at the threshold, this hunger so close to being met, it was amazing, but also exquisite and rare, that insistence should have quite dropped from me. Discretion. Discretion. Could it save the situation? I wouldn't touch the door. I wouldn't touch it. I'd only wait a little to show, to prove that I wouldn't. I listened, as if there was something to hear. And this attitude between us, while at last it was its own communication. If you won't, then good, I spare you. I give up. We both should have suffered. I retire, never to try again. So rest forever. Rest and let me. I turned away. I turned away. I turned away and retraced my steps. And finally, at the other side of the house, I did what I had never done at these hours. I opened half a casement and let in the air of the night. Spell was now broken, and it didn't matter. The empty street. Its other life, so marked even by the great lamplit vacancy, was within call, within touch. High above I watched, as for some comforting common fact, some vulgar human note, a scavenger, a thief, some night bird I would have blessed, positively welcomed that sign of life. But nothing. Oh, nothing. A discretion even there. Not the least stir of the great grim hush. The life of the town was itself discreet, under a spell. Great builded voids. Have they ever spoken so little to any need of the spirit? Great crowded stillnesses with its sinister mask. Oh, it was this large collective negation that proved to me at last what a night I had made of it. I thought, of course, of retracing my steps. There was, after all, the whole rest of the house to traverse for me to leave safely. Safely. Unless the door had meanwhile opened and he was once more at large and in possession. But if I saw the door open, if I saw it, it would send me straight to this window and make my way uncontrollably, insanely, fatally to the street. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. Look. That hideous chance I avert only by recoiling in time from assurance. Ah, assurance, ah. Assurance, assurance. I have the whole house now to deal with. My instinct is all for mildness, but I ran through the rooms, the passages, to finally the top of the stairs. Mildness, yes, I take it all with no rush. No rush, but quite steadily. Steadily. The house seems immense. The scale of space inordinate. They might come in now, the builders, the destroyers, they might come as soon as they want. Do you hear all you rooms, all you steps and flights? The wreckers will have you. The wreckers will have you, a splintered pile. I descended as if to the bottom of the sea. The last flight to the lower hall. Oh, there, the marble floor. The squares, black and white, of my childhood. Only to cross these once more to the door to safety. To safety. The vestibule gaped wide. The inner door had been thrown far back. That one I had closed. Oh, at last, he, to meet, to touch, to know. The penumbra, dense and dark, was the virtual screen of a figure which stood in it as still as some image erect in a niche. Or as some black-visored sentinel guarding a treasure. A treasure. My liberation. Oh, my supreme defeat. Gray, glimmering margin. The central vagueness diminishing, taking form. It was somebody. Somebody, something. What made the face dim was a pair of raised hands that covered it, buried it. The head was bent. The figure wore evening dress of gleaming silk lappet and white linen. Pearl buttons. Gold watch guard. Polished shoes. A pair of thick eyeglasses hung from a string. My revulsion had become immense. He hides his face from seeing. Standing there for the achieved, the enjoyed, the triumphant life, yet he can't bear to be faced. Wasn't the proof in the covering hands? The hands. So spread that I could see that one of the hands had lost two fingers. They were reduced to stumps as if accidentally shot away. But even so, the face was guarded. Guarded and saved. Coward. Coward, show yourself. Show yourself. Ah. No, it isn't mine. It isn't me. It is hideous, monstrous. It fits me at no point. Imposter! Imposter! The face is that of a stranger. It approaches, comes upon me nearer. He is evil, odious, blatant, and vulgar. He advances as for aggression, and I, sick with the force of his shock, fall back under this life larger than my own, this rage of personality under which my own collapses, turns to darkness, gives way, is gone.
Mr. Brighton. Oh, ma'am. He's coming round, I think. Mr. Brighton, sir. You gave us a scare, you did.
Mrs. Muldoon, he'll be all right. Would you fix something?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I go to my place for some tea now, or broth. Some broth would be better now. I'll only be a few moments now.
Mrs. Muldoon, don't bother.
She's gone. She'll be right back. Don't move. Lie here a moment. We found you here in front of the vestibule. You had fallen.
Oh, where was I?
We thought you were dead.
It must have been that I was. Oh, yes, I can only have died. You brought me to life. How?
And now I shall keep you.
Oh, keep me. Keep me. Keep me, Alice. But how did you know to find me?
I was uneasy. You were to have come. Do you remember? And you sent no word.
Oh, yes, I remember. I was still out there in my strange darkness. Where was it? What was it? I must have stayed there so long. So you knew of this, of what has happened?
I've known that you've been coming here.
Known?
Well, I believed it after our talk here.
That I'd persist.
That you'd see him.
Ah, but I didn't. There's somebody, some beast that I brought to bay, but it is not me.
No, thank heaven, it's not you. Of course, it wasn't to have been.
But it was. It was that. I was to have known myself.
I, too, saw you.
Saw me?
Saw him. It might have been at the same moment, in my dream again. He came back to me. I knew it for a sign that he had come to you.
He didn't come to me.
You came to yourself.
Now, yes, I've come to myself thanks to you. But this brute with his awful face, a black stranger, he's none of me, even as I might have been.
Isn't the whole point that you'd have been different?
As different as that.
Haven't you wanted to know exactly how different? But anyway, you appeared to me.
Like him?
Yes. A black stranger.
And how did you know it was I?
He told me you had seen him.
You liked him. You liked him, that horror.
I could have. He was no horror. I had accepted him.
Accepted?
I didn't disown him. I knew him. You, my dear, so cruelly didn't. You saw only his difference. Well, he was less dreadful to me. It may have pleased him that I pitied him.
Pitied?
He's been unhappy, ravaged.
And haven't I been unhappy? Am I not ravaged?
I don't say I like him better. But he's grim, he's worn. Things have happened to him. His glasses, I recognize the kind, for his poor ruined sight. And his poor right hand.
And he has a million a year. He has a million a year. But he hasn't you.
And he isn't you. He isn't you.
Mr. Bryden. Oh, sir, you're all right again, I see. Now, shall I bring the tea to you here, or can you come outside?
We'll go outside, Mrs. Muldoon.
We're all right now.
Go ahead, Mrs. Muldoon. We'll follow. No, he isn't you. He isn't you.
That was The Jolly Corner by Henry James. You heard Eric Bowersfeld as Bryden and Pat Franklin as Alice. The technical production was by John Whiting, with music composed by Peter Winkler. The bassoon was performed by Bill Kaufman, and the story was adapted for radio by Eric Bowersfeld. And now, good night.
The Black Mass was produced for KPFA, a Berkeley, California radio station. It also found an audience on KPFA in Los Angeles, but never had a network affiliation. It was another sincere attempt to rekindle the embers of old-time radio drama. It was unfortunate, in this connection, that the show never found a regular heartbeat and aired on an irregular schedule between 1963 and 1967. Well, here we are at the top of the second hour of the show. And that, of course, means science fiction. This week, we're going to have an episode of Exploring Tomorrow called The Happiness Effect. This is an adaptation of a short story by Raymond Banks, which was published in Astounding Science Fiction in November of 1953, and then aired on Exploring Tomorrow in 1958. The host of the radio show, John W. Campbell, was the editor of Astounding Science Fiction from the late 30s all the way through the 1970s, by which time the magazine was being called Analog Science Fact and Science Fiction. Campbell is universally considered to be one of the great science fiction editors of all times. Discovering, well, he would say he discovered Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, a raft of others. Anyway, here we go.
Exploring Tomorrow. And now here is your guide to these adventures of the mind, John Campbell, Jr.
There's the old saying, you'll do it and like it. And, of course, a man can, by physical force, make you do it. How would you like to have it so that you would like it, too? There are two basic ways that you can be happy in this world. One, of course, is to have everything you want in just the way you want it and never have any difficulties or troubles. This method is ideal, perhaps, but not very probable. Only one person in the world could have that, I guess. The other method, for absolute complete happiness, would be to like anything that you got, no matter what it was. The first approach is the one that makes sense, of course. That's the one we work for. We earn it. The other seems so much easier.
Stop barking! Stop barking! Stop barking! That's all right, doggy. You bark as much as you want. Oh, how I wish I could get mad. In the old days, I'd have gone up that dog and told him to shut up, and that had been that, but no more. Just as soon as I start to get good and sore about something, my mind kind of all creams up in the happiness effect, and I'm not sore anymore. And everybody here in Benton, I guess most everybody in the country is just like me. We've all had our brains written on, and we're all happy. Here I am, chief of police of Benton, and never a crime to speak of unless it's overtime air parking, and what kind of crime you call that?
Henry!
Oh, here he comes. Our own Doc Roy, the man responsible for all our happiness. He's supposed to be just about the best brain writer this side of the Mississippi.
Henry!
Slobbo, that's what I call him. Old wet lips, always do good and always grinning. But behind that grin, believe me, ice. If you need an enemy, just have Doc Royden for a friend.
Henry, didn't you hear me calling to you?
Oh, sorry, Doc. I guess I just kind of stand here thinking.
Happy thoughts, I hope.
Oh, sure, happy thoughts. Sure. What can I do for you, Doc?
A fellow just came into town, suspicious. Painting pictures out at Willow Hollow.
There's law against painting pictures at Willow Hollow?
Now, Henry, you know I got to keep my eyes on things. Wasn't for us brain writers, there'd be all kinds of irresponsibles roaming around. And these artists, they're the worst kind, you know that. You remember there was a day when you were headed for that kind of trouble?
Yeah, I remember. I was pretty good baritone, too. You sure brain wrote me out of that notion.
And aren't you better for it? You're a responsible citizen, happily married, well-adjusted, doing a job that's socially useful.
Yeah. What about this fella I'm supposed to investigate?
The name of Arnold Vivian.
And he's been painting up at Willow Hollow?
That's right. Doesn't do anything all day long but paint.
Single?
No wife, no children, no nothing. He just paints.
Well, remember, as long as he just paints, that's legal.
Now, Henry.
Now, don't Henry me, Doc. I'll look into it. That's all I can promise.
All right, that's all I ask. All right. Goodbye, Henry. Mighty pretty landscape you're painting.
Why, thank you. Willow Hollow makes a mighty pretty landscape to paint.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's all right. I never mind a little talk when I'm painting. What can I do for you?
Your name Arnold Vivian?
That's right.
I'm Henry Horner, chief of police.
Nice to meet you. Chief of... What seems to be the trouble?
No trouble. I just out here to give you a kind of friendly warning.
About what?
Now, this town of Benton you're in needs new young men, Arnold. If you should happen to get in any trouble here, we got a real fast brain rider who likes to straighten people out.
I don't get into trouble.
Well, just keep in mind, we need workers these days. Like our brain rider would say, who needs pictures on canvas?
Who needs pictures on canvas? Why, Mr. Policeman, me. Maybe someday a few others will agree with me.
Well, maybe. I used to be a sort of artistic fella myself. Baritone concert style.
Yeah, I bet you're good on a police whistle, too. Don't worry about me, Mr. Horner. Just go back and tell your brain writer. Here's one traveling man he won't ever get to use his scalpel on.
Every Saturday night, Benton has a dance. I usually don't go near it myself because since the brain writing, everybody's pretty well adjusted and ain't any police-type trouble. This Saturday night, though, I dropped in toward the middle of the evening.
Hi, Mr. Horner.
Hi, hello, Arnold. Having a good time?
Heck yes. I've been dancing with all the girls. They love me and I love them.
Staying out of trouble?
The only trouble I ever have is with pictures on canvas.
Well, don't go getting drunk and signing a job contract with Big Fellum at the Brickyard or with Tom Harth or you'll forget pictures.
I'm immune to job contracts. Also, it may interest you to know that both Mr. Harth and Mr. Fellum each bought a painting for me tonight, paid cash on the barrel head.
Well, that's a surprise. Well, I wonder what they're up to.
Why should they be up to anything? They just like my pictures. I guess they like me, too. They invited me to play poker with them after the dance tonight.
You turned them down, of course.
Heck no. I like taking money from people at poker.
Well, they're more likely to do the taking, and once you're broke, you'll just have to go to work.
Mr. Horner, when are you going to stop worrying about me? I told you, I can take care of myself.
And he could, too. When the poker game broke up about 3 a.m., he was the winner. Everybody was griping, all except Doc Royden, who sat there, his close-set eyes glittering behind thick spectacles.
Imagine him taking me for 30 bucks. Imagine.
Well, he knows people, he knows cards, he knows women. You're not going to brain-write that boy.
You want to bet, Henry? You just want to make a little bet.
That's right.
Henry, wake up and scoot over to Tony Holland's shack on the edge of the holler.
What's the matter, Doc?
There's been a crime. Get over here as fast as you can.
Somebody's got to keep an eye on our citizens at the police force.
Now, wait a minute.
Well, it's a good thing I was out this way.
Where's Tony?
I gave him a sleep injection. The poor fella, he was bashed on the head and all his savings were stolen. $302.
Well, can't you wake him up so he can tell me himself?
No need. I got all the information you want.
Who does he think did it?
He doesn't know, but I've got a good idea.
Yeah, like who?
Well, let's eliminate. It couldn't have been a passing tramp. Since brainwriting, there aren't any. And if you can't say it was anyone in town, they're all adjusted and wouldn't commit no crimes.
So?
Might be somebody around who wanders in the hollow in the daytime, poking around and pretending to be what he ain't.
Well, it wasn't Arnold Vivian.
How do you know?
Because he's not that stupid. He knows he'd be the most likely suspect.
Maybe you just better check up on him, Henry.
Doc, you're the brain writer. They called you in after the maladjusted guy's been caught, but I'm the cop. I run my investigations the way I want, and I'm not going to build a case against Arnold Vivian.
What are you going to do?
You write on brains. Try reading one.
So you figure Doc Royden's trying to frame you, huh?
Looks that way.
Well, it's ridiculous. I just took you people at poker for enough money to live for 3 weeks. Why should I take a chance on getting my head written on?
Have you missed any of your stuff?
Oh, just my pen and pencil set that I lost jumping around at the dance last night. Hey, wait a minute. That'd make a fine clue, wouldn't it, at the scene of the crime?
It sure would.
Well, was it found over there?
Not yet, but it will be. That's not important, though. What is important is this. Tony Holland has one peculiarity. He marks $20 bills. Figures he can follow how the money goes around town that way. Now, you don't draw any money from the local bank or in salary, so you just better not have any local $20 bills marked by Tony.
Hey, whose side are you on?
I used to sing baritone, remember?
Police, I like you.
Artist, I kind of like you, too.
Henry! Look what we found at Tony's. Look here.
Yeah, I know. You found a clue, a pen or a pencil or both. We know all about it, Doc. Arnold, I better run you in, at least until we can investigate further. It'll look better.
Why, certainly. No trouble at all, Mr. Horner. Glad to come along.
I pressed for a hearing right away, figuring that Arnold could be cleared and then leave town. He figured the same, that it wasn't healthy to hang around a place that needed new talent so bad. The hearing went real fine. From the start, I testified that Arnold had been fast asleep at the time the crime was committed, and I swore that the pen and pencil had been planted in Tony's house. Then suddenly they were talking about marked $20 bills.
Well, I couldn't possibly have any 20s, Judge. I just told you, I there's absolutely no way that I could have... Unless... No. No. Let me out of here! Let me out of here! It's a frame-up! It's a frame-up, I tell you!
There is no tool that is either good or evil. There's nothing that in itself is good or bad. It's the way it's used. Logic is a wonderful thing, of great value to man and his progress. But in this trial here... You've seen what can be done with logic when someone is out to prove what he wants to prove and is not in the slightest interested in getting the truth.
Just one thing I want to say. I've seen a lot of raw deals, but the way you have it here with the singing cop to set it up is the slickest I ever saw. You win.
As chief of police, I had to be present at the brain writing. Doc's nurse gave Arnold the needle jab in the back of the neck, and after that, he sat there like a stone man, able to hear, but paralyzed.
Now, Henry, there we are. Yes, the clay model is ready to take the impressions from Arnold's brain, so we'll have an exact duplicate. Now we put this cap on Arnold's head, so the electronic fingers in it can do the measuring. A good boy. It won't take long. Attach these wires to the automatic computer that we put above the clay model, and there we are. An exact model of Arnold's brain. All right, let's take a look. Oh, me. Oh, my. There's a brain that needs writing. All right. Look here, you see that? Decayed memory spots. Artistic imagination, decayed sensory impressions, quite useless in an adjusted society. Now, we just take the scalpel and start doing away with these 6 synapses in the brain model, substituting good ones. Isn't that what we do, Henry?
Yeah, that's what we do, all right. You erase the bad ones and carve some good ones, and then when his own brain gets the impression, the guy's adjusted from then on. Everybody does what they should, and they don't need no religion, no morals, no psychology, nothing.
Just brain writing and the world's work gets done.
Now, Henry, you always miss the most important part. After I get rid of the illogical synapses, I do one special cut with my stylus. There, I'm doing it now. And that's the happiness effect. Then your adjusted man not only does what he ought to, he's happy about it.
There we are. Oh, that looks beautiful. Oh, that looks almost like the master brain. Let me get it and show it to you, Henry. It's real interesting. I'll be back in a second.
You know, Arnold, I sure wish I could help you. Wait a minute. Maybe I can. I'm going to try to put back some of those synapses he cut out. Here's a scalpel. You know, there's one he did. There's another. Maybe I can help you keep some of your artistic talent, Arnold. Yeah, here's a final one.
That one day, Henry, we'll be able to duplicate this master brain in everyone. It's brilliant. Take a look at it while I prepare for the transference from the clay model to Arnold's brain.
It sure is fine looking, this master brain.
Yes. Now, we're ready to go? Now, Henry, when I close this switch, the new brain shape will flash the signal to the cap on Arnold's head, the electronic fingers will dig in, and he'll have a new brain. Oh, I tell you, Henry, this is the real moment of birth. Most people are born wrong for this world. This is where they get right. All right, here we go. It's going to hurt a little.
Well, Henry, we did it. We created a useful citizen.
Well, 6 months went by, and it looked as if Doc was right. Arnold took a job, settled down, and got himself married, and then...
Henry, have you seen that picture exhibition up at the town hall?
Picture exhibition? No, Doc. What's it about?
Arnold Villian, the sneak. Pictures of me, holding me up to ridicule. I'll be the laughingstock of this town. You've got to stop it.
Well, there's nothing illegal about pictures, Doc, but come on, let's take a look. We went to the town hall, and there was the neatest collection of pictures you ever saw. Arnold had painted Doc Royden more than 50 times, and in each picture he cut the basic evil of the man. Doc was shown at the council meeting, at church, at the dance, his face revealing every grimace of deceit, power, lust, conniving. Every picture was titled The Happiness Effect, and everyone was marked sold already. I knew then and there that Doc Royden was finished in battle.
Henry, please, I'm too old to start over in another town. I've got to stay in Benton. Please, Henry, get rid of those pictures.
Why, Doc, it sounds to me like you're maladjusted to your environment. You ought to be brain-written with a happiness.
Henry, man, I've been looking all over for you. I wanted to tell you thanks for using Doc's scalpel to save a piece of my talent.
Why, it was a pleasure, Arnold. Thanks to you for giving us back a little human dignity. People tend to think that happiness is something you have. But I think it isn't. I think it's more in the nature of something you do. You know, the founders of our country were no fools. And in the Declaration of Independence, they said that men had certain inalienable rights, among which were the pursuit of happiness. No man has ever declared that happiness itself is a right of man. The pursuit of happiness is. It's worth working for.
Join us for a fascinating adventure in Exploring Tomorrow.
Heard in our cast tonight were Mason Adams, Charlie Holmes, and Lawson Zerbe. Script was taken from a story by Raymond Banks. Produced and directed by Sanford Marshall here in New York. Bill Maher speaking.
For our final segment, we're going to swing by South Africa to give a listen to Michael McCabe's Beyond Midnight series. This is a story about how one man chooses to celebrate his 40th birthday. It aired in 1969.
Another day. 17 left. 17 short, swift days. And you'll be 40, Robert Holmes. 40 years old.
Yes? Oh, leave it there, please. No, on the table there.
Thank you.
Generally, it is the so-called frailer or weaker sex who are so conscious of the passage of time that they hear the knell of doom in the number 40. Generally speaking, that is. To Robert Holmes, though, 40 held all the terrors that modern man can imagine within its two crisp syllables. 40. 17 days short. Oddly, with each succeeding year, the age gap between him and Nell was seemed to widen, as if time were carrying him along and leaving her behind. In the beginning, she had looked at him as being attractively mature, while now he felt she regarded him as growing old. It was no trick of the imagination, the way he saw Nell was looking at the younger men in the club, and a number of them, young bucks like Edward Mathis, were not about doing something about it. Poor Robert. He should have done something about it himself. Instead, he allowed it to prey on his mind, and that pathetic little number, the one that comes after 39, carried him beyond midnight.
Biotech, the new soap and pre-wash powder, presents Beyond Midnight by Michael McCabe.
I had a letter recently from Mrs. V.P. Head of 7th Street, Parkmore, Johannesburg, and she said, I cannot fully describe my utter delight on returning to the washing to find the stubborn stains of 2 months standing completely removed. I am so glad I discovered your product, Biotech. And now Mrs. J. Longman of Cambridge, West East London, wrote to say, just a word of thanks for your new soak and wash powder Biotex. I find it almost too good to be true. I've just finished my first packet, and I washed all my baby's woolens with it, and they really do stay white. And what is more, they keep their shape so well, too. Once again, thanks for a wonderful product. I'm just hoping you won't wait too long before putting a large economy-sized packet on the market. Well, thank you, Mrs. Head of Parkmore, and Mrs. Longman, for your endorsements. I, too, can endorse Biotech by making certain claims to you, ladies, the most important of which is that with Biotech, the stubbornest, the very stubbornest stains just vanish merely by soaking.
I'll get it, darling. Hello.
Oh, hello, Bill. Look, I've been dying to hear what happened. 29. That's all she is. Looks 23. Got beauty. Money, too. Always gregarious. Gray falling out. How about
She got a few lines. That woman backwards. She's getting younger.
Five. Yes, of course, still love. Five.
Nine.
Robert, you see, felt his security imperiled. In fact, he had completely, by this time, convinced himself that the only answer to his problem lay in his wife's death.
Oh, dear. That devil, she is the military, really.
Well?
Well, you know Belle.
No, I don't.
Oh, of course you do, darling. Belle Crimmer. She got married last spring to that tennis player, John or something or other. John. Oh, terribly surprised. He's at least 7 years younger than she is. Nevis thinks he's the most beautiful man she's ever known. I've never seen hair so fair, and he's got so much of it.
Yes, so was her youth, vitality, and longevity was a family trait. This combination virtually eliminated all chance for a natural death. Thus, Robert Holmes found himself with a sole possibility. In order for Eloise to die, he would have to kill her himself.
One dry martini.
Ah, oh, thanks.
You and your martinis, Mr. Holmes. I always thought it was only Americans who drank them. Give me a nice pint any day of the week.
Right.
As the desert breeze. You've never been to America, have you, Mr. Holmes?
No, I've never been to America.
They say it's a wonderful country. That's a nice cigarette case, Mr. Holmes.
Hmm? Yes, so wife gave it to me for my birthday.
You look out at Huntington, don't you, Mr. Holmes?
Mm. That's right. 134, on the hill.
That's a nice house, I know it. It's got a tennis court, garage for four cars. It's big.
Mm.
I used to work with the bloke who owned it, during the war. Jack Conyers owned it then. He was a bootlegger.
A what?
That's why they call him in the States, Mr. Holmes. Distillers of and runners of black market liquor.
Oh.
During the war, the customers telephoned their orders, and we get the stuff out of the stockroom under the garage and send it out to them at black market prices. Police were never able to
room under the garage? But there's no room under the garage.
Well, it's probably been filled in a long time ago. But there used to be one under there. There was a trap door in the garage floor and some steps leading down. The door was on a spring, and you had to push it in a certain place to make the trap open. Oh, yes. Oh, excuse me. Got to go as customers.
Hello, Bobby boy.
How are you? Oh, Charlie, you celebrating?
Well, wife's gonna wait. Visiting her sister. First time she's left me for 15 years.
Oh, look. I might be telling tales out of school and all that, but I just saw your charming bride.
Well,
maybe I ought to keep my big mouth shut.
What? Come on, you're drunk it up with it.
Well, I've been around the town to a few pubs today.
That I can see.
Mm. Well, I was in the Domino earlier on, and that's where I saw Elwood. She was with a youngster called Mathis.
Mathis? Edward Mathis?
Yes, Edward. That's the one, Edward.
You're sure?
Well, look, Bob, I've had a few drinks, but there's nothing wrong with my eyesight. Oh, he's a smart one, that Mathis. He's...
That is smart.
What would you like to do on your birthday, Bob? It's only a couple of weeks off, you know. You'll be 40.
You don't have to remind me.
Hmm? What? Would you like to get a crowd together and go to the club?
I'm not particularly looking forward to this birthday, if you don't mind.
Oh. Well, you'll be 40. Oh, don't be absurd. You know what they say, life begins at 40.
Oh, for heaven's sake, turn it a cliche. I don't act so blasted smug. One of these days, you too are going to be 40.
40's a long, long way off from me yet. Oh, still, it's nothing to be afraid of.
He glanced down the long table at his wife. She had a secret of that, he was sure.
9 years they've been married now, 9 years on her money. Even his job in her father's brokerage firm would go down the drain if anything happened to their marriage.
Is anything wrong, Bob?
What did you do today?
Oh, nothing important. Went to the club, played 9 holes, and...
With whom did you play?
What is this, Robert? An inquisition? But just what is this all of a sudden? You're acting like a suspicious, peevish old man.
Oh, forget it. I've had a bad day at the office. Forget it.
Lovely yellow. Oh,
hello. Hello. One of the most beautiful cars I've ever seen.
Yes.
Mamma mia. Would you ask Mathis if he's not too busy? I'd like to see him. Eh?
Oh, Ed won't be in again until this afternoon. Shall I ask him?
No. Never mind. I'll come back again. Some other time.
To blazes with work today. That's what Holmes thought that morning. He drove home again. Her car was not in the garage. He moved moodily about the house for a while, drank 2 drinks, and then suddenly remembered what the barman had said about the old trap door in the cellar of his house. With a strange excitement, he went to investigate. Something had clicked in his mind.
Right. I saw the Bellevue. Don't seem to be in here.
No, he wasn't telling fairy stories. And it isn't Holden either.
Quickly, Holmes grabbed the flashlight and, climbing through the trap, made his way down the flight of stone steps into... what? The room under the floor was large, approximately the size of the garage itself. The mold-encrusted ceiling was formed of steel I-beams surmounted by the concrete garage floor. The 4 walls were concrete, too. The floor was hard-packed earth. The air was close and fetid.
That's it. This is the answer. A few details here and there. And my future is secure. Mm-hmm.
On a Thursday, a week and 2 days before his 40th birthday, Robert Holmes decided not to go to work. He told his wife he had some paperwork to wade through, and accordingly he shut himself into his study and waited. An observer hidden with him in that room, though, would have observed that the gentleman in question opened no books, picked up no pens. Instead, he merely waited and listened, close by the door. After a while, he heard Eloise go to the telephone, make a call, and agree with one of her women friends to play golf that day. She replaced the phone, just as Robert stepped out into the hall.
Oh, hello, darling. Finished already?
No, just taking a breather.
Well, I hate to make you jealous.
What's that?
Hmm?
Well, what's that on your neck?
Neck?
Yes, Robert did a very workmanlike job of throttling Eloise. As soon as he had finished, he carried her down to the room under the garage and buried her in the shallow grave he had dug the day before. By the time he carried this out, washed his hands and straightened his tie, barely 5 minutes had passed. In another 15 minutes, he was sitting at his desk at his office in town. Came 4:30 that afternoon.
Miss Cook, I've got a bit of a nasty pain in my stomach. In fact, I don't feel well at all. I'd like you to ring my wife, please. If she's not at home, she'll be either at the Dawson's or with some friends.
I'm sorry, Mr. Holmes, awfully sorry. I've tried all the places you said, but no one sees her today.
Huh?
This Mrs. Bascom said she talked to your wife this morning. They were supposed to play golf together. Apparently, Mrs. Holmes just didn't turn up.
Hmm. That's strange.
Yes.
Very strange. Not like Eloise at all. Did you try my home phone?
Oh, yes, sir. That's the first place I tried. No one answered. How is your tummy feeling now?
It's getting worse than anything. Must have been something I had at lunch.
Well, you shouldn't go home if there's no one there.
Here. That's the number of the woman who does for us. It's Thursday today, the day off. Look, call her and explain the situation. Tell her to take a taxi out to the house and say I'll be there within the hour.
Would you like me to drive you home, Mr. Holmes?
That's very nice of you. I hate to inconvenience you, though.
Oh, it's no trouble, sir. I'll get your hat and coat, shall I? You won't need a briefcase, will you? Or is there something?
Yes. No, quite. Yes, of course. No, I phoned them. Yes. No, I suppose not. Oh, thank you. Oh, what about the last of the hospitals? I think it is the last within 20 miles.
Well, could she have gone on a trip, do you suppose?
No, she'd have told me. Anyway, our car's still there.
Maybe you should call the police. Mum had to do that about Dad once. They found him 3 months later, sitting in the park in Enchester, feeding the pigeons.
Well, if I don't hear anything within the hour, I will call them. Yes, I better do that. Now, where's Mrs. Ruddy Watson? You phoned her. She promised to be here.
I don't want to keep you. I've told you before, Sergeant Wilkins, and I'll tell you again. People do not simply disappear. She's got to be somewhere.
Oh, you've checked and rechecked everywhere she could have left the town, Inspector. And she didn't, please. She's still here somewhere. Yeah, perhaps we'd better let the newspapers have a crack at it.
You know that's out. Her father is a very big man. The editors of some of the biggest national papers are like Siamese twins to him, let alone the locals. He doesn't want anything in the paper about it. He says she might have just gone away for a while and doesn't want to be embarrassed.
You know, that husband knows more than he's saying.
Maybe he killed her.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me one bit.
And what did he do with the body?
Well, maybe he buried her. Maybe he dissolved her in acid and washed her down the drain. I don't know what he did with it.
He'd been through and over every darned inch of the ground on the property. If just supposing he did bump her off, Sergeant, where the heck did he bury her?
Well, anyway, Holmes can account almost for every second from the time Mrs. Bascom talked to his wife on the phone until the time he found in the missing persons report. His alibi's too darn good.
A jury doesn't convict people for having good alibis.
And suddenly a whole new world opened up before Robert Holmes. Exciting possibilities. There were no boundaries, it seemed to him now. The world was his oyster. He decided that it was a holiday he was needing. A long, long holiday. Of course, he'd keep the house. He would refrain from letting it or anything stupid like that.
Can't let the bloody thing.
Not with what the room under the garage contained.
Not with what
Although, of course, who could ever find it?
But then, no one could ever find it.
They might just get into conversation with the barman.
Might just happen to talk with him, don't you? Oh, a little bit dodgy.
Certainly would. Imagine it.
Oh, so you're in number 134 on the hill. Used to work there 3 years ago. Before the present owner, of course. Rich geezer is now. His wife disappeared in mysterious circumstances. It's never been found. Some people reckon he had something to do with it. But they never managed to make anything of it. Guess what? Underneath the garage floor, there's this cellar place. All you do, as I remember, is to find a certain place on the wall.
Oh, no. Definitely not Robert Holmes.
Certainly not. Look the whole place up. Put it in the hands of reliable lawyers and take it. I'll return from time to time, of course.
Of course. Otherwise,
people might think I've run away.
South of France, I think. Then Switzerland.
It'd be wise to check with that inspector chap, I think. After all, it's only been 9 days. All the beautiful ladies in the world are waiting for you, Bob Holmes. 40? 40? What sort of an age is 40 anyway to a man with money?
Oh, hello. Inspector Jason, please. Yes, I think he is expecting me to ring. Thank you.
Bless you. Touch you very much.
Hello. Inspector. Robert Holmes, here?
Yeah? Yes.
No, I... Look, Inspector, I've got to get away just for a while. It's been a terrible strain on me, as you can imagine. France. Yes, of course. And if she turns up, as I'm sure she must, the silly girl, now that you can contact me. No, I'm sorry, Inspector. I will not allow such a terrible possibility to prey on my mind. Now, I'm sure she merely decided on the spur of the moment to... Oh, thank you. That's nice of you. But it's perfectly all right, then. I mean, I thought I'd just check. Good, fine. Well, as soon as I've got an address, I'll... Yeah. Right, cheerio. Thank you for all your help.
No ordinary day, this. It was Robert Holmes' 40th birthday. He had allowed the woman who did for him leave for an indefinite period. On a generous retainer, of course. He began to pack. Then he discovered an annoying thing. He couldn't find the diamond-studded tie clip that Elwaz had given him for his 39th birthday. He tried to remember when he had last worn it. It had been the day he had killed Elwaz. He remembered dressing and waiting for her to make a phone call. Later, he had carried her down to the room. He had placed her in the grave and covered her.
It's got to be down there. It's the only place it can be.
Oh, I can't believe it. Got at least £1,000. Diamonds are huge. Anyway, anyone ever found the ruined plant? And the tight lip was there, too. No, there's no risking around.
I'm alone.
And so, accordingly, he got a torch, opened the trap, and started down the stairs. He was halfway down when he heard the car approach.
Oh, the blazes. A couple of them.
To the trapdoor above him, Robert realized that the car and whoever had driven it there had come into the garage. It had to be the police.
I'll wait for you here.
It's not the police.
Several minutes passed. Then came another voice.
Nobody seems to be home.
That door.
But no one came when I rang.
I'll be in the bar.
She said delivery this morning. I'm watching for that. It's impressive. What do we do?
Suddenly, Robert recognized the second voice. Ed Mathis.
We'll leave it how it is. It's careful. We'll go back to the room.
Waiting a decent interval, Robert searched for the tie clip and found it. Now he's ready to go. South of France. Blue waters and film starlets with loose morals awaited him. Swimming. Fishing. Sailing. Golf? The door remained shut. He placed his back against the trap. He strained against it with all the power of his back and neck. And then he felt a wave of terror. Like a page slowly unfolding before him, he saw it. Ed Mathis. The secret meeting with Eloise. Mathis was a car salesman at the place where he had admired the beautiful car that day. His birthday. 40. Standing there like a poised missile, just inches above him, the yellow, beautiful sports car. With one wheel resting firmly on the trap door.
Darling, let's go out and paint the town red.
But what about your headache?
Oh, that's gone. Grandpa headache powders did the trick.
Grandpa headache powders kill pain, soothe strained nerves, and lift depression. Grandpa headache powders are extra effective because they have a triple action. Grandpa headache powders work extra fast because they dissolve almost immediately. Get fast, effective relief from any pain, all pain. Get Grandpa headache powders.
Ah. Grandpa. Soak. Soak.
That's all you have to do.
Soak. Soak.
Just for an hour or two, you'll find the soap that orders you when you use your biotech.
With amazing new biotech, the stubbornest stains will vanish. Yes, vanish clean away. Just by soaking your laundry overnight in cold water, or for an hour or two in warm water, or by pre-washing it quickly in your washing machine. Get amazing new biotech today.
Beyond Midnight is presented every Friday night at 9:30 by Biotech, the new soap and pre-wash powder. The program is adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe.
Well, folks, that's pretty much it again. I hope you enjoyed yourself and will come back next week. This is Gary Clinton. This is Billy May playing Ira Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.